This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Hello, I'm Alan Stanford, and welcome to Macbeth in Monaghan.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
Go, get him, Sir Dilemma!
God save the king!
The victory fell on us!
Hooray!
What he had lost, noble Macbeth had won!
Look, what I have! Show me, show me!
Hark!
Macbeth!
Macbeth! Hark!
That shall be king hereafter.
Stay! You imperfect speakers, tell me more!
Beware the thing of the fight!
What? Can the devil speak true?
Oh. Look to the lady!
Come, you spirits! Attend on mortal thoughts!
Duncan comes here tonight.
Thanks.
Bring forth men, Shirley. This is a sorry sight.
Macbeth does murder sleep. Macbeth shall sleep no more.
A little water clears us of this need.
Wake Duncan with thy knocking. I want that corpse.
Horror!
Make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings. Which of you have done this?
Murder and treason!
Hello and welcome again to St. Louis Secondary School in Carrickmacross in County Monaghan for the second programme in Macbeth in Monaghan. Now today we're going to deal with the third cycle of the play. As we discussed in the last programme, we can break it down into five cycles. The cycle of the prophecy, of the murder, of the betrayal, of the genocide, and of the revenge. And today we're going to look at the betrayal. Performing today will be students from Patrician High School and the St. Louis Secondary School. As we enter this cycle of the play, the Macbeths have succeeded in their plan to kill the king and take the crown. Macbeth is now king. The prophecy of the witches has been fulfilled. But that's not the end of it, because something is beginning to worry Macbeth. The prophecy, we must remember, promised more than the crown to Macbeth. It made a promise as well to Banquo. Banquo was told that he would be father to a line of kings. In other words, Macbeth gets the crown now, but Banquo inherits the future. A future that has nothing in it for Macbeth. Banquo gets a whole destiny where his offspring become kings. Macbeth isn't happy about this. Why should he have gone through all that to give the future to Banquo? So, Macbeth, in his mind, makes a simple decision. Banquo must go, and his son Fleance must go with him. They've got to be killed. This is the first moment in which Macbeth steps away from the prophecy and thinks he can become the master of his own destiny, a destiny that the fates, the witches, the weird sisters, have already outlined for him. So, he will betray his closest friend and in consequence will unleash on himself, or within himself, the freedom to kill whoever he wants to with complete impunity. He's going to step from king to tyrant in one easy move. Kill Banquo. Banquo himself, at this point in the play, is also feeling a little uneasy about the prophecy.
Thou hast it now, king, corridor, glams, all, as the weird women promised, and I fear thy place most foully for it. Yet it was said it should not stand in thy posterity, but that myself should be the root and father of many kings. If there come truth from them, as upon thee, Macbeth, their speeches shine, why by the verities on thee made good, may there not be my oracles as well, and set me up in hope. but hush, no more.
In other words, Banquo is himself becoming fascinated by the truth of the prophecy. He was the one at the beginning who said, this could be the devil, this could be something that we shouldn't get into. Now he's saying quite clearly, their speeches shine, that what they prophesy is good, it happens. Of course, he has no idea that it was Macbeth that murdered Duncan. He simply says, what they said was true. And as I said in the last program, everything that the witches say is true.
Ride you this afternoon.
Aye, my good lord.
Tonight we hold a solemn supper, sir, and I'll request your presence.
Let your highness command upon me, to thee which my duties are within most indissoluble tie forever knit.
Is it far you ride?
As far, my lord, as will fill up the time, twixt this and supper.
Fail not our feast.
Fail not our feast. Now, Macbeth may come to wish that he hadn't demanded that particular service, because Banquo will be there, but not as either he or Macbeth might have wished him to be.
My lord, I will not.
Hie you to horse, adieu. Till you return at night, ghost fleance with you.
Aye, my good lord, our time does call upon us.
It's interesting. Ghost fleance with you. He's almost lulling Banquo into a false sense of security. You going off for the afternoon? Ah, yeah. Oh, that's okay. Come back tonight. We're going to have a bit of a dinner. Will you come and join us? Yeah, be fine, yeah. Lovely. Now, don't forget, be there, won't you? By the way, is your son going with you? And it's that casual, gentle question to make sure that the two victims are going to be in the same place at the same time. Macbeth is learning to be very clever about the way he goes about his business.
I wish your horses swift and sure of foot, and so I do commend you to their backs. Farewell.
And Banquo has gone off for his last ride, and Macbeth is now going to ensure that Banquo never comes back. So, thank you to Raymond Martin and to Patrick Moynihan from Patrician for reading those parts.
My name is Cormac McKenna from St. Martin's College. My favourite scene in Macbeth is the banquet scene, Act 3, Scene 4. It provides the audience with the first sign that Macbeth's downfall will be self-inflicted, and that it is his mental instability that results in his and his wife's fall from power. I felt there was a degree of irony in this scene, in that Banquo was at his most dangerous and effective toward Macbeth, having been murdered. Now the ghost of Banquo disturbs Macbeth and causes what should be a joyous celebratory occasion to become a distressing farce of an event.
Hi, my name is Jessica Lee and I'm a student here in Laurel Hill Secondary School in Limerick. The quote that I've chosen is, "Renown and grace is dead, the wine of life is drawn, and the mere lees is left this vault to brag of." I particularly enjoyed this quote from Act 2, Scene 3 of Macbeth, as it encompasses Macbeth's emotional state of mind at this stage and signifies the beginning of the downward spiral into doom, evil and tyranny which ensues. By committing Duncan's murder, Macbeth has disregarded and ignored all of his core fundamental moral values. Throughout the beginning of the play, Macbeth struggles to suppress his insatiable lust for power, but fails helplessly in this attempt. He realises that he's destroyed his morality, compassion and honour when he declares that renown and grace is dead.
My name is Raymond Martin from Patrician High School, Monaghan. The quote I've chosen from Macbeth is, "It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." This shows how Macbeth no longer puts any stock in being alive. He has seen and done such horrific things that he's become apathetic and lost the will to live. He is suggesting that life is an empty and pointless endeavour and therefore has no reasons to live. However, it also strengthens his resolve against the approaching enemies as he no longer fears his own death.
Let me mention at this point the principle of the soliloquy. It's a golden rule in Shakespeare that everything that you think, you say. So if a character has to ponder on an idea or a thought or an image, it comes out as a soliloquy, a speech which is almost like a stream of consciousness, a thought. And in this coming soliloquy, Macbeth assesses his position before he goes into addressing the question of how to do the murder. And that's the principle of the soliloquy. Macbeth assesses his position and finds it wanting.
To be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus, our fears in Banco stick deep, and in his royalty of nature reigns that which would be feared.
Now, in his royalty of nature, in other words, Macbeth is acknowledging that Banquo has royalty of nature, that he's actually very suited to be a king. And within that is something that Macbeth should be afraid of.
He chid the sisters when forced to put the name of king upon me, and bade them speak to him. Then prophet-like, they hailed him father to a line of kings. Upon my head they place a fruitless crown, and put a barren scepter in my grip, tense to be wrenched with an unlineal hand, no son of mine succeeding. If it be so, for Banquo's issue have I filed my mind, for them the gracious Duncan have I murdered, put rancors in the vessel of my peace, only for them, and mine eternal jewel, given to the common enemy of man, to make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings. Rather than so, come fate into the list and champion me to the utterance.
And that was Patrick Moyner from Patrician reading Macbeth. And now Dennis Bates of CBS Sexton Street, Limerick, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
I'm going to talk to you, firstly, about the definition of the soliloquy, and secondly, about how to prepare an answer on the soliloquy for exam purposes. A soliloquy, from the Latin solus loqui, meaning to speak alone, is a dramatic device in the Shakespearean play. Shakespeare uses it for two purposes, the first of which is to allow the character to reveal their inner thoughts, what's on the speaker's mind. The second purpose of the soliloquy is to allow the character to engage in a dialogue, typically with himself or maybe with the audience. But in that dialogue, the character is able to work out what they're thinking, what's going through their mind, what their attitude, what their response is to that, what strategy they're going to adopt following whatever the events may have been. In Shakespeare's play Macbeth, the soliloquy is used as a very powerful dramatic device. And Shakespeare uses it for two purposes. The first of those is to allow us to hear what Macbeth is thinking. And the second of those is to allow us to hear Macbeth arguing with himself as he goes through the rights and wrongs of a situation and as he develops his strategy for responding to them. Now, if you're writing an answer, what we have said so far would allow you to write a good introduction. A good introduction would include a statement of the question that you're answering. It would include a definition of the terms that you're going to use, and it would also include an outlining of the parameters or the boundaries of the answer that you're going to write. We'll take a look now at what would go into the body of your answer. We've established already what the soliloquy is. We now want to see how Shakespeare uses the soliloquy in the course of the overall play. To do this, we're going to talk about it in a number of stages, because what Shakespeare does is to start the soliloquies as stage asides. A stage aside, if you like, is a little soliloquy, a small comment, again spoken by the character but not heard by anybody else except the audience. And of course, the audience are outside the world of the play, looking in, listening in. In Act 1, Scene 3, when the witches are telling Macbeth the prophecies, Macbeth responds with a series of spontaneous asides. They tell him, for example, that he's Thane of Glamis and Thane of Cawdor. He knows he's Thane of Glamis, but he's astonished to be called Thane of Cawdor. They tell him then that he may be king hereafter. This is shocking for him, and in an aside expresses his astonishment and his immediate reaction, which is that these things are so improbable that if chance would have him king, then chance would make him king, as he says in that scene. The further we go into Act 1, we see the soliloquy now being used for a more important purpose. In Act 1, Scene 5, for example, Macbeth speaks some of the longer soliloquies. In these, he's giving us his considered opinion, his inner thoughts. He has now been bitten by the bug of becoming king, but he knows that it's impossible in every proper sense. He cannot be king because morally he has no right or entitlement to it. His soliloquies become more complex as the scenes evolve through Act 1. And they reveal to us the character of Macbeth as a complex man, very aware of what's going on, who has a finely tuned conscience, but, fatally, a conscience which he is not willing to act on. In his soliloquy starting, "Is this a dagger I see before me?" he ends that soliloquy having talked himself into a stalemate. And when he hears the bell, which Lady Macbeth rings, the bell signalling that the bedtime drinks for the Duncan's guards are ready, Macbeth's response is, "Hear it not, Duncan, for it is the knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell." In a sense, you could say Macbeth is saved by the bell or perhaps damned by the bell, but it's the bell which stops his thinking and prompts him to go into action. Later in the play, when we move into Act 4, Macbeth speaks a number of soliloquies, though by this time the soliloquies are shorter and more pointed. Macbeth realises that he has made a major mistake in killing Duncan and that what he has done is wrong and unforgivable. Macbeth also realises that it is inevitable that he must fail. He says to us in Act 4 that he is so far steeped in blood that to go on is as easy as to go back. He says to us again when news is brought of the forces ranging around his castle at Dunsinane to lay siege, he says that he will still continue, that he will at least die with armour on his back, and so on. Shortly later, he speaks the words, "From this moment, the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand." In a sense, he is abandoning his head, his reason, his conscience, his faculty of conscience, and moving to a life governed by feelings, a life governed by the impetuous heart and furious, impassioned action, the life of the hand. So we see at this point Macbeth moving towards his final end, and in his ever-shortening soliloquies he is telling us how more desperate and how more unreasonable and spontaneous his actions are going to become. A good answer ends with a strong conclusion. So a good technique to use here is to take the opening sentence you had at the beginning of your answer and to rewrite it as a concluding statement. In our discussion, we've looked at the soliloquy by definition, the solus loqui, the speaker speaking alone to himself. We have spoken of the soliloquy as a dramatic device in the play, and we have seen how Shakespeare uses the soliloquy to chart the progress of Macbeth's character and action through the play, starting with short asides, proceeding to long and complex soliloquies, returning to shorter soliloquies as the play moves forward, and ending in brief statements at the conclusion. Thus, throughout the play, we have seen that Shakespeare uses the soliloquy as a very powerful dramatic device to reveal the characters and also the unfolding development of the action.
Now, let's remind ourselves, Macbeth gained power by an act of assassination, a political murder. Not put on by hatred, not put on by revenge, not because he hated Duncan. He just simply committed assassination in order to gain the crown. Now, with that crown very firmly on his head, and everybody very happy that it's there, he begins to corrupt other people. He decides he's not going to kill Banquo. He's going to keep one step removed from that, and he's going to get others. He uses assassins. And not just any common or garden murderers at that. He uses men who have a grudge against Banquo. He's using men who he can then blame. Well, they did it because they hated Banquo. There are always grudgers and moaners everywhere that you can use. He uses men who he convinces are the victims of Banquo.
Have you considered of my speeches? Know that it was he in the times past which held you so under fortune, which you thought had been our innocent self. This I made good to you in our last conference, passed in probation with you. How you were born in hand, how crossed the instruments who wrought them, and all things else that might to half a soul and to a notion crazed say, thus did Banquo.
You made it known to us.
I did so, and went further, which is now our point of second meeting.
Macbeth is saying, everything you thought that I might have done to make your lives rotten was actually done by Banquo. And Anyone but a madman would understand that. Nobody likes being told that if you don't believe me, you're mad. So they believe him.
Do you find your patience so predominant in your nature that you can let this go? Are you so gospelled to pray for this good man and for his issue, whose heavy hand had bowed you to the grave and beggared yours forever?
We are men, my liege.
Aye, in the catalogue ye go for men. As hounds and greyhounds, mongrels, spaniels, curs, and demi-wolves are clept by the name of dogs. Now if you've a station in the file, not in the worst rank of manhood, say it, and I will put that business in your bosoms, whose execution takes your enemy off.
Very interesting point here. Macbeth is saying to them, are you men? Are you not just dogs? Are you real men? And it's exactly the same argument that Lady Macbeth used to him when he was afraid to commit the murder. Are you a real man? When you durst do it, then you are a man. And exactly the same argument is used now by Macbeth to convince these two poor, miserable guys that they're real men, and because they're real men, they'll go out and murder Banquo.
I am one, my liege, when the vile blows and the buffets of the world have so incensed I am reckless what I do to spite the world.
And I another, so weary with disasters, tugged with fortune, that I would set my lie on any chance to mend it or be rid on't.
Both of you know Banquo was your enemy, so is he mine.
There's an interesting step. He's taking these low, common people, he's convinced them that Banquo is their enemy, and now he's saying, and I'm just like you guys, he's your enemy, and he's mine. And he's convincing them that he is one of them, that they're all three mates together.
Within this hour at most, I will advise you where to plant yourselves, acquaint you with the perfect spy of the time, the moment on it, for it must be done tonight, and something from the palace, and with him, to leave no rubs nor botches in the work, fleeing the sun. He must embrace the fate of that dark hour. Resolve yourselves apart. I come to you anon.
We are resolved, my lord.
Abide within.
And he's saying, we're going to do it quietly. We're going to do it away from the palace. We're going to do it tonight. Oh, and by the way, we're also going to kill his son. And he slips it in at the end, oh so gently, and they say yes.
It is concluded, Banquo. Thy soul's flight, if it find heaven, must find it out tonight.
And thank you to Patrick Moyner, who read Macbeth, and to Micheál McConnell, and to Paul McMahon, who were the murderers.
Hello, I'm Robin Eames, formerly the Church of Ireland Archbishop of Armagh. And I'm going to comment on the theme of conflict and genocide in Shakespeare's play Macbeth. You know, I feel the use of violence, murder by Macbeth, to achieve a political end in the play as it is, raises all sorts of issues for us as people. Not that we all go out to commit murder or to get what we want, but like Macbeth, we often have our own sense of what we can be or what we are capable of achieving if only there weren't things or people in our way. We look at Macbeth and feel comfortable saying that Macbeth was wrong. The choices that Shakespeare presents to us seem so stark and clear. But on a daily basis, I feel, we all face our own Macbeth moments. And I wonder if we are all so good at applying moral judgment as we would like to think we are. Macbeth is clearly inspired by the witch's prophecy, and the first steps towards achieving his ambition fall so easily into his grasp when he becomes Thane of Cawdor. It is but a short step to the killing of Duncan and making the prophecy come true. So with the subsequent murder of Banquo, I feel that Shakespeare puts the assassination of Duncan into its proper context. Murder is murder. Genocide for political ends is an absolute abuse of power and authority. The fact that Banquo's son survives in order to fulfill the truth of the witch's prophecy, that Banquo would become father of a line of kings, that makes it clear that for Shakespeare, Macbeth's murderous progress was never necessary. It is a complete evil that sows the seeds of his own destruction, and it paves the way for the unleashing of genocide or mass slaughter, and ultimately involves the whole nation in bloodshed before Macbeth and the old order is defeated and rule of justice is restored.
Hi, I'm Kate Mitchell, and I'm from Laurel Hill Secondary School in Limerick. My favourite Macbeth quote is, "All hail Macbeth, that shalt be king hereafter." I like this line because it shows the witch's personality well. They are mischievous, meddling women, and confusing Macbeth is of great entertainment to them. They come across almost childlike, with an I-know-something-you-don't-know attitude about them. They not only bring an element of darkness to the play, but also some humour. They giggle and cackle among themselves while taunting Macbeth. It seems as though they would have teased whoever happened to pass by them, but knowing what they know, they deviously attract Macbeth's attention, knowing their information will be of great interest to him. I also enjoy the riddle-like way in which the witches speak. Nothing is clear with them. That shalt be king hereafter lets Macbeth dare to believe that he could possibly be king. Yet this seems impossible, but his readiness to believe it shows his secret ambition. The enigmatic prediction makes it intriguing.
My name's Sarah Woods and I'm from Monaghan Collegiate School. I really enjoyed Shakespeare's use of the language to reinforce the central themes of the play Macbeth. In particular, I liked the disease imagery which highlighted the tyranny of the character Macbeth. Macbeth's rule is described as distempered. The disease of tyranny has spread throughout the whole country, and so like a disease, Scotland must be purged. Life itself is seen as one long illness by Macbeth, who envies Duncan's escape from life's fitful fever. He tells his murderers that as long as Banquo lives, he wears his health but sickly. In Act 5, Scene 3, Macbeth asks the doctor, "Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased?" In the last act, the doctor can do nothing for infected minds, which he thinks need divine help. However, there is hope for the future since Scotland's disease can be cured by Malcolm and the medicine of the sickly will.
My name is John Lillis and I'm a student in St. Nessens Community College in Limerick. My favourite character in the play is Lady Macbeth. We see how from the start of the play to where she kills herself towards the end that her character weakens. At the start, before Duncan's murder, she is the powerful one in their relationship. Literally speaking, she is the one that wears the pants in their family. After the murder, we see how Lady Macbeth is still strong, but she is slowly weakening. In the banquet scene, she supports Macbeth when he sees the ghost of Banquo, but this is the last time we see her supporting him. After this scene, she slowly starts to lose her mind. We see this in Act 5, Scene 1, the sleepwalking scene, where she reenacts the murder where she's washing her hands. And eventually, after this incident, she kills herself to relieve herself of her pain.
So, Macbeth has entrapped the murderers. He's offered revenge to them, and they very gladly take it. More importantly, he's learning the art of manipulation. He's learning the skill of controlling people and getting them to do what he wants. He's giving people an opportunity to release in themselves their own vengeance. But in spite of this skill and this success, he still can't rest easy. There are still things going on in his head that won't go away. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that since the murder of Duncan, he hasn't had a good night's sleep. Even his wife can see a change in him.
How now, my lord? Why do you keep alone? Of sorriest fancies your companion's making, using those thoughts which should indeed have died with them they think on. Things without all remedy should be without regard. What's done is done.
There she is, being the practical wife again. She said, look, it's done, you can't fix it, you can't go back, everything's happened, let's just get on with life.
We have scotched the snake, not kilted. She'd close and be herself, whilst our poor malice remains in danger of a former tooth. But let the frame of things disjoint, both the world suffer. Ere we will eat our meal in fear and sleep, in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly.
In the affliction of these terrible dreams which shake us nightly. He's saying quite clearly, I can't rest, I can't relax. It's all in my head, all the time. And what we have done is not completely finished. That term, we have scotched the snake, not killed it. She'll close and be herself. That traditional image that if you chop a snake or a worm in half, it'll close up again, which of course is completely untrue. But that idea is in his head. Unless I complete what I have to do, I've got nothing.
Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further.
It's a wonderful image. I killed Duncan, which was the kindest thing I could do to him, because he's got no more worries. I, on the other hand, who am alive, am worried about everything. There's something wrong in that equation. Lady Macbeth keeps trying.
Come on, gentle, my lord. Sleek o'er your rugged locks. Be bright and jovial among your guests tonight.
Oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. Thou know'st that Banquo and his fleance lives.
But in them, nature's copies, not eterne.
There's comfort yet. They are assailable. Then be thou jocund. Ere the bat had flown his cloistered flight, ere to black Hecate's summons the shard-born beetle with his drowsy hums hath rung night's yawning peal, there shall be done a deed of dreadful note.
What's to be done?
Now this is the first evidence that Lady Macbeth has that something else is going to happen. He's not discussed it with her. It's not part of their plan. Her plan is now complete. Duncan's dead, Macbeth is king, nothing else. Suddenly, at this moment, she realizes there's more going to happen.
Be innocent of the knowledge, dearest Chuck, till thou applaud the deed. Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day, and with thy bloody and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale.
Again, he's calling in the night. He's calling in the darkness, as Lady Macbeth called for the darkness to come and shroud what was going to be done. Yet again, Macbeth is doing the same. Come, sealing night, scarf up the tender eye of pitiful day. And more importantly, with thy bloody and invisible hand, cancel and tear to pieces that great bond which keeps me pale. And that great bond is life and Banquo.
Light thickens, and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse, while night's black agents to their praise do rise. Thou marvel'st at my words, but hold thee still. Things bad begun make strong themselves by ill. So pretty, go with me.
I particularly love that little sequence because it's one that just about anybody can recognise, especially if you live in the country. Light thickens. It's like any evening. Light thickens. You know this point. Just in the twilight, it makes it something rather dank and heavy. And the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. We all know that image. We've all seen it. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse. Light is going. While night's black agents to their praise do rouse, it's the foxes and the badgers coming out. So what he's doing is establishing the mood for the next event. And so, thank you to Laura Fitzsimmons from St. Louis as Lady Macbeth, and again to Patrick Moyner from Patrician as Macbeth.
My name is Ken Ellis, and I'm a student at St. Essence Community College, Limerick. My favourite scene in the play is Act 2, Scene 3, for many reasons. It begins with the porter at the door of the castle, who allows people in. He's very drunk and almost asleep at the door when Macduff and Lennox knock. They complain about him taking so long. The porter explains to Macduff about the effects of drink in a very funny and humorous way by saying, "Drink, sir, is a great provoker of three things. It provokes nose painting, urine and sleep." This scene gives us a bit of comic relief in the midst of all anguish and death happening around the characters and gives the audience a break and a release of tension. The porter also gives a funny quote about drink, which relates to the coarser side of the audience and helps them relate to the play. It provokes the desire but takes away the performance.
My name is Paula Keenan. I go to Inver College and I will be speaking of The End of the Tyrant. This is the scene where Macbeth finally meets Macduff on the battlefield. Macbeth, after killing Macduff's wife and children, finally shows his conscience as he says, "Of all men else, I have avoided thee." This is the clash between good and evil, of light and dark. After seeing remorse in Macbeth for the first time, we finally see fear in Macbeth. This fearless warrior, upon hearing of Macduff's circumstances at birth, now shows fear for his life. Despair thy charm, and let the angel whom thou still hast served tell thee, Macbeth was from his mother's womb untimely ripped, And yet Macbeth says, I will not yield.
My name is Emma Hazlett and I am from Monaghan Collegiate School. My favourite moment from Macbeth is in Act 5, Scene 1, the sleepwalking scene. This is when the audience sees the full effect of the murder on Lady Macbeth. In this scene, she is a nervous wreck. She cannot sleep. She is afraid of darkness. She cannot clear the memories of the murder from her mind. The scene highlights the most dramatic change in Lady Macbeth as she learns the most valuable lesson. One can look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent underneath it. Eventually, your conscience will catch up with you, and you must either face it and dismiss it like Macbeth, or be destroyed by it, like Lady Macbeth. This play teaches us all a valuable lesson in life about the power of the conscience and our efforts to justify wrongdoing. It is not the public knowledge of the wrongdoing which will destroy the character, but the internal knowledge that one has done wrong.
So, Shakespeare has set the scene. We've got light thickening, and the first image we get from the murderers is of the sun finally setting.
The west yet glimmers with some streaks of day, now spurs the lated traveller apace, to gain the timely inn, and near approaches the subject of our watch. Hark, I hear horses.
Then, 'tis he, the rest are within the note of expectation, already are in the court.
Give us a light there, ho!
A light, a light.
'Tis he, stand to it.
It will be rain tonight.
Let it come down.
O treachery, fly, good fleens, fly, 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 thou mayst revenge, O slave.
Who did strike out the light? Was not the way. There's but one down. The sun has fled.
We've lost best half of our affair.
Well, let's away and say how much is done.
We've lost best half of our affair. In other words, they failed. They were sent out to kill Banquo and Fleance, and they only killed Banquo. That's not a problem, because Macbeth's problem is not the problem of Banquo, but the problem of Banquo's line, that he's sons and sons and sons of sons will become king. He tried, as I said, to sidestep the prophecy, and he failed, because the prophecy must come true. Fleance cannot die, so he survives this terrible assassination attempt. What has been done here is not an assassination, but the murder of a friend. Not the political killing, as with Duncan, but a cheap and savage murder. And thank you to Micheál McConnell, to Raymond Martin, and to Paul McMahon, all from Patrician, for reading The Murderers and Banquo. And now Sonia Sexton of St. Louis, Carrickmacross, is going to give you a sample answer to a question on Macbeth.
I'm going to look at an approach to the following question. Macbeth is a man of noble disposition, dragged down by his connection with his wife's coarser nature. Discuss. When approaching a question such as this, it is generally a good idea to decide whether you agree or disagree with the statement and to do so in your opening paragraph. For this question, I would suggest you could argue that indeed Macbeth does seem to have a noble disposition at the beginning of the play, and there is substantial evidence that the coarser nature of his wife does influence the uxorious Macbeth in his initial bloody deeds, but ultimately Macbeth is responsible for his own downfall. This opening statement, which refers precisely to the question posed, will form the basis for your answer. After your opening paragraph, you should discuss noble disposition as it relates to the character of Macbeth. Macbeth's credentials are clearly established at the beginning of the play through the testimony of others. For example, brave Macbeth, well he deserves that name, spoken by a sergeant in Duncan's army. Macbeth's noble disposition is further asserted when Duncan rewards his loyalty and bravery in battle by giving him the title Thane of Cawdor. Interestingly, he is rewarded for his bloody execution on the battlefield. We are spared no detail when it is recounted how he unseamed MacDonald from the nave to the chaps and fixed his head upon our battlements. It is clear his nobility largely lies in his bravery for and loyalty to Duncan and Scotland, and as a warrior on their behalf. Further evidence of a possible noble nature, however, is found in Macbeth's awareness of his bond to Duncan and Scotland and his position of double trust. This awareness of his obligation to protect Duncan, not murder him, is perhaps a sign of an initial noble nature. Similarly, his guilt, however brief, after the murder of Duncan, points to a noble disposition. Now, having established Macbeth's noble disposition, you should develop your answer by focusing on Lady Macbeth and the bountiful evidence of her coarser nature. Principally, you will be examining her language in Act 1, Scene 5. Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty. In this scene, we see Lady Macbeth's control and single-mindedness as she rejects her natural femininity and asks for the cloak of blackest hell to mask her evil intent and actions. We further see her coarser nature in Act 1, Scene 7, when she uses graphic imagery and emotional blackmail to bring Macbeth from, we will proceed no further in this business, to, if we should fail. Her brutal negation of her maternal instinct in the lines, "I have given suck," is shocking, and her coarseness is not lost on Macbeth, as he states, "Bring forth men children only, for thy undaunted metal should compose nothing but male." Crucially, Lady Macbeth succeeds in quelling Macbeth's misgivings, and they proceed with their plans to murder Duncan. When you have discussed Lady Macbeth's coarser nature and established her influence in relation to Duncan's murder, you need to draw a line under the influence she brings to bear on Macbeth's behaviour after the murder of Duncan. There is a limit to her influence. Macbeth moves on to even more heinous crimes as Lady Macbeth effectively disappears and Macbeth himself takes centre stage. Her last sane act is desperately trying to calm the guests in the banquet scene. At this point in your answer, you need to show that Macbeth is responsible for his own downfall. Now might be a good time to briefly consider the role of the witches. It is important to remember, however, that within the boundaries of this specific question posed, it would be wrong to dwell too long on the witches. For the purposes of this question, you must show that their influence is limited. Remember, the witches appear to both Banquo and Macbeth, yet Banquo, while tempted, does not act. The witches even admit in Act 3, Scene 5, that what they are doing is an illusion. Their business is not destiny, but trickery. Macbeth refuses to accept this, and significantly is further drawn to them the more desperate he becomes, and actively seeks them out in Act 4, Scene 1. This very deliberate act of meeting the witches and his unwavering trust in their subsequent apparitions is an integral part of Macbeth's autonomous fall from grace. This he did by himself without consulting with his wife. At this point in the argument, you can outline other significant episodes where we see Macbeth's independent capacity for evil. Consider the murder of Banquo and attempted murder of Fleance. Lady Macbeth is not privy to Macbeth's plans at this point. He tells her to be innocent of the knowledge. The attack on Macduff's castle and the murders within are also highly significant when establishing Macbeth's responsibility for his own downfall. The following key quotations are important at this juncture. "I am stepped in blood so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er." These words are spoken by Macbeth in Act 3 and Scene 4, and indicate his state of mind, where he feels that he has passed the point of no return in terms of bloody murder, and it is easier to keep going than to turn back. Another important quote in relation to Macbeth's independent tyranny is, "From this moment the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand." These words clearly articulate Macbeth's intention to act without reflection, consultation, or recourse to moral judgment. And so, to conclude your answer, you should reiterate the terms of the question. Yes, Macbeth was a man of noble disposition. There is no doubt that the coarser, persuasive nature of his wife influenced him strongly to murder Duncan, and indeed the witches had some influence also. However, at a certain point, Macbeth made his own independent descent into darkness and dragged himself down. Macbeth is ultimately responsible for his own downfall and probably realises it himself. It could be argued that Macbeth regrets, but one thing is for certain, if so, he regrets too late. Nothing can change the fact that by the end of the play, noble Macbeth has been well and truly replaced by a hellhound, a dead butcher, a tyrant.
So to recap, Banquo had done nothing wrong, posed no threat. Banquo is murdered. murdered to protect Macbeth's position, but more important, to prevent Banquo's line becoming king's. The prophecy told Macbeth he would be king, told Macbeth he would be the head of a line of kings. The prophecy must be true. So Fleance survives. Just, let us remember, as Malcolm, Duncan's son, also survived. Macbeth instructed Banquo not to fail the feast. And Banquo keeps his word. With all the other guests assembled, Macbeth complains of the fact that Banquo is absent. And Banquo appears.
Here had we now our country's honour roofed, with the grace person of a Banquo present. Who may I rather challenge for unkindness than pity for mischance?
His absence, sir, lays blame upon his promise. Please, your highness, to grace us with your royal company.
The table's full.
Here is a place reserved, sir.
Where?
Here, my good lord. What is it that moves your highness?
Which of you have done this?
What, my good lord?
Thou canst not say I did it. Never shake thy gory locks at me.
Gentlemen, rise. His highness is not well.
Sit, worthy friends. My lord is often thus, and has been from his youth. Pray you, keep seat. The fit is momentary. Upon a thought, he will again be well. If much you note him, you shall offend him and extend his passion. Feed and regard him not.
Lady Macbeth knows that something's seriously wrong, because Macbeth seems to be losing it. There's nothing in the room, nothing for him to see. Nobody else can see anything, but he's going crazy.
Are you a man?
Aye, and a bold one, that dare look on that which might appall the devil.
Oh, proper stuff. This is the very painting of your fear. This is the air-drawn dagger which you said led you to Duncan. Shame itself. Why do you make such faces? When all's done, you look but on a stool.
She knows what's happening. She knows there's something clicking in his brain. He told her about that famous dagger that he saw before him with the gouts of blood on it. She knows this is just pressure working on him. So she tries to explain to him, you're just imagining it.
Pretty, see there. Behold, look, lo, how say you? Why, what care I? If thou canst nod, speak to. If charnel houses and our graves must send, those that we bury back, our monuments shall be the maws of kites.
Banquo's ghost, whether it's real or imaginary, is tipping Macbeth over the edge. He's actually beginning to lose control.
If I stand here, I saw him.
Fie for shame.
Blood had been shed ere now, in the olden time. Ere human statue pours the gentle wheel, aye, and since too murders have been performed, too terrible for the ear. The times have been that when the brains were out, the man would die, and there an end. But now they rise again, with 20 mortal murders on their crowns, and push us from our stools. This is more strange than such a murder is.
His guilt at seeing the ghost is the first crack in his armour. He sees the ghost and the guilt starts to flow out of him. And he's going to actually say it all in front of these people unless she can shut him up. And he makes statements that are so extreme. The times have been that when the brains were out, the man would die. I mean, it's a glorious image. When you kill somebody, they're dead. So what are they doing coming back? All of these confusions, all coming with this great well of guilt, again proving to a degree that this is not a monster. This is just a man who's done something monstrous, an ordinary man like you and me.
It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood. Stones have been known to move and trees to speak. Augurs and understood relations have by maggot pies and choughs and rooks brought forth the secretest man of blood. What is the night?
Almost at odds with morning. Which is which?
How sayest thou that Macduff denies his person at our great bidding?
Did you send to him, sir?
I hear it by the way, but I will send. There's not a one of them, but in his house I keep a servant feed.
It's an interesting little side point as well, that already in the households of all the nobles, all the thanes, Macbeth has got a paid spy.
I will tomorrow, and be times a will, to the weird sisters. More shall they speak, for now I am bent to know. By the worst means the worst.
By the worst means the worst. I will go and summon up demons to find out the truth. He now knows that no matter what he does, his destiny is set. That he can't change it. So now he realizes he needs to know more.
For mine own good, all causes shall give way. I am in blood, stepped in so far that, should await no more, returning where as tedious as gore, strange things I have in head that will to hand, which must be acted ere they may be scanned.
You lack the season of all natures, sleep.
Come, we'll to sleep. My strains and self-abuse is the initiate fear that wants hard use. We are yet but young indeed.
This is where the next major change takes place in Macbeth. First, the realization that the dead don't stay dead. The ghosts of those we kill will always be with us, seeking revenge, and that there's now no turning back. He begins to realize that the only way of understanding what has happened must be to go back to the source of the prophecy. He must find out the truth by the worst means, by trafficking with evil. And then that most awful confession. I am in blood, stepped in so far, that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as gore. He's reached the point where there is no longer a road back. The prophecy has driven him to commit himself to this terrible course of action. He has lost his way in the blood of his victims, and in order to survive, he now knows he's got to wade a lot deeper in blood. So thank you to Rona Lennon as Ross, Patrick Moyner as Macbeth, Daryl Caplice as Lennox, and Mary-Kate Markey as Lady Macbeth. And in today's quiz, representing St. Louis, we have...
Catherine Ward.
From Patrician.
Daryl Caplice.
From Collegiate.
Amy Boyd.
And from St. McCartan's...
Brian Boyd.
So, we begin with a question to each of you. Catherine, your question. Who says, I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition which all leaps itself and falls on the other?
Macbeth.
Correct. Daryl, who says, Macbeth doth murder sleep, the innocent sleep that knits up the raffled sleeve of care?
Macbeth.
Correct. Amy, who says, a little water clears us of this deed?
Lady Macbeth.
Correct. And now Brian, who says, and prophesying with accents terrible of dire combustion and confused events, new hatched to the woeful time, the obscure bird clamoured the livelong night?
Ross.
Wrong. Sorry, it's Lennox. So, round two. Now, in this one, you're each going to be played part of a recording from the play, and I'm going to ask you a question about it. Catherine, here's yours.
Do you not hope your children shall be kings, when those that gave the Thane of Cawdor to me promised no less to them?
That trust at home might yet enkindle you unto the crown besides the Thane of Cawdor. But 'tis strange. And oftentimes to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell us truths, win us with honest trifles, to betray us in deepest consequence.
Now, who's speaking to whom?
Macbeth to Banquo.
Correct. That's 2 points. And Daryl, here's yours.
Was it so late, friend, ere you went to bed, that you do lie so late?
Faith, sir, we were carousing till the second cock, and drink, sir, is a great provoker of 3 things.
Huh? What 3 things does drink especially provoke?
So, who's speaking to whom?
Macduff to the porter.
Correct. Well done. 2 points. Amy, here's yours.
What is a traitor? Why, one that swears and lies.
And be all traitors that do so?
Everyone that does so is a traitor, and must be hanged.
And must they all be hanged that swear and lie?
Everyone.
Who must hang them?
Why, the honest men.
Then the liars and swearers are fools, for there are liars and swearers enow to beat the honest men and hang up them.
So, Amy, who's speaking to who?
Lady Macduff and her son.
That's correct. 2 points. And the last one is for you, Brian.
What is thy name?
Thou'lt be afraid to hear it.
No, though thou callst thyself a hotter name than any is in hell.
My name's Macbeth.
The devil himself could not pronounce a title more hateful to mine ear.
No, nor more fearful.
Thou liest, abhorred tyrant. With my sword I'll prove the lie thou speak'st.
So, Brian, who's speaking to who?
Macbeth to young Sire.
That's correct. Well done. So that's 2 points each again. And now, these are the quickfire questions, so let's have your fingers on your buzzers, and off we go. How will Lady Macbeth summon Macbeth to commit the murder?
Striking a bell.
That was Catherine from St. Louis. That's correct. Lady Macbeth says, I've drugged their possets. What is a posset? Yes, Catherine.
It's a type of drink.
A type of drink, yes. To be actually accurate, it's a sweet, spiced milk curdled with wine or ale. Sounds revolting. Who is Hecate? And that was Daryl.
The Queen of the Witches.
That's correct. With what implements will Macbeth commit the murder? That's Catherine again.
Two daggers.
Correct, two daggers. To whom do the daggers belong? Yes, that's Amy.
The grooms.
To the grooms or the chamberlains, yes, correct. Who discovers Duncan's body? That's Daryl.
Macduff.
That's correct. Why does Lady Macbeth return the daggers to the grooms? That was Catherine.
To make it appear that the grooms murdered Duncan. That's correct.
Where does Malcolm go after the murder? Catherine again.
To England.
To England, yes. Where does Donald Bane go? That was Amy.
To Ireland.
To Ireland. Much more sensible choice. Where will Duncan be buried? That's Brian.
In Columbkill.
Columbkill is correct. Who does Macduff suspect are behind the king's murder? And Daryl.
Duncan's sons.
That's correct. Why is Banquo suspicious of Macbeth? Daryl again.
Because of the witch's prophecies to Macbeth.
That's correct. Why are Malcolm and Donald Bane suspected of their father's murder? Catherine.
Because they fled.
Stolen away and fled. Who does Macbeth ask the three murderers to kill? That was Amy.
Banquo and the son.
Correct. And there we are. And at the end of today's quiz, St. McCartan's 3, Collegiate have 7, Patrician have 8, and St. Louis have 10. Our production crew today was Kevin Reynolds, Catherine Brennan, Sean Rocks, and Orla Cotter, with Tony Lyons on sound. And I'm Alan Stanford of Second Age Theatre Company. Join us next week when we examine the genocide in Macbeth.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.